welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And a little later in the show, we're going to be talking about unions under the Trump regime and some of their struggle to fight back, the future of climate politics, and of course, a little bit about Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor. And speaking of that, before we can move on, well, that was fast. Controversial National Security Advisor Michael Flynn has resigned after only roughly a month on the job. Interestingly enough, it wasn't that Flynn once promoted Pizzagate that got him fired. It wasn't that he routinely had expressed bigoted views that pushed him out. It also had nothing to do with the fact that he seemed hell-bent on a war with Iran that caused trouble. Nope. It was a relatively mundane phone call during the presidential transition. Flynn has more or less been marked from the beginning by those seeking to heighten tensions with Russia, in particular the varying neocon warmongers and their friends in the intelligence and diplomatic world, and I should also say the media, and he clearly seemed to view Russia as a key ally in his desired war with quote-unquote radical Islam. And it seems fairly obvious when you look at the guy's record, Flynn isn't some sort of strange Russian dupe, but someone who is a zealot in the service of his cause. Flynn has caused Islam a cancer and generally seemed to be more or less an adherent to the Clash of Civilizations worldview, which pushed Flynn in the direction of trying to bring America and Russia closer together, which also meant, on his part, not being afraid to go into Russian media and make his point. This, of course, led to him being tagged nefariously from the jump. Not for any of the justified reasons I've listed so far, but for not having the general view of the foreign policy establishment, which is outright hostility towards Russia at all times, and an attempt to use NATO to push a containment policy of sorts. And his reputation as a poor manager, Flynn, that is, seems to be well taken here, as he seems to have blundered into an unforced error. We actually don't even know what was allegedly said in the phone calls between the Russian ambassador and Flynn, but the allegation is that they discussed sanctions and that Flynn told the Russians not to retaliate to the sanctions leveled by Obama in December, because relations would improve between the United States and Russia once Trump became president. Except we don't know if that what was said, and no one says they know for sure, really. Intelligence agencies simply leaked to the press that they believed Flynn may have done so, and that there were some discrepancies between what he said on the call and what he told some administration officials, including Mike Pence, and no one will release the transcripts. Flynn does at least admit the topic of sanctions came up, but that's about all we have looking at all this major furor. That's all the evidence that's really behind it. Now, had Flynn just come clean, he probably would have survived the fear in the first place, but it is, of course, not that rare for transition officials to have contact with foreign countries, and only the most naive would believe that despite the screams of Flynn breaking protocol, that sometimes these touch talk on, gasp, upcoming policy from the next administration in some way. And I mean, we know Richard Nixon for sure, and probably Ronald Reagan actually did far worse in trying to tilt the election itself in their favor by interfering with the diplomacy of the incumbent presidents they were facing in the elections. How it is at all shocking that the top security advisor to a president who essentially spent one whole year campaigning on all but rolling sanctions back would slightly tip their hand to the Russians just about a month before they actually took office. But Flynn, for whatever reason, decided to lie about it, and he gave his enemies what they needed to push him out. Flynn should absolutely be nowhere near the lever of power, but not because of a couple of phone calls to the Russian ambassador, but because he has demonized entire religions, trafficked in dangerous conspiracy theories, and sought to further war that could have led to the deaths of millions. The obsession with turning Russia into an enemy is really becoming extraordinary, with the media openly reporting information fed to them by the CIA, NSA, FBI, or factions within them, in league with anti-Russian senators and neocon foreign policy think tank types. Of course, the whole truth is never really leaked. It's just little small bits here and there, and then it's summarized with these filler quotes from anonymous officials of this or that agency, making vast assertions of what is essentially, in their words, this is what they're asserting now, a criminal conspiracy by a foreign country to take over the United States. Now, those are pretty serious charges, being bandied about in ways that have vast consequences for not only this country, but the world. If people are going to make them, they should back them up with some more serious evidence and less deep throat parking garage type of innuendo. And one other thing worth noting for everyone celebrating Flynn's demise, as good as it may feel, the choices to replace him are a clear sign that the problems being faced, like militarism, are systemic, not individual. All the potential replacements in the current acting national security advisor have deep experience in the military-industrial complex and have been enthusiastic participants in some of the most disastrous adventures of the past decade. The current acting national security advisor, former Army General Keith Kellogg, was literally the COO, Chief Operating Officer of the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was the occupation of Iraq, if you will, from 2003 to 2004. And since then, he's been a hired gun at various tech companies working in the murky world of cyber warfare and surveillance with some of the most notorious military contractors around. Also under consideration is David Petraeus, devotee of the drone wars that have killed thousands of innocent civilians, along with the special forces assassination squads that go along with them. And, of course, someone who actually was convicted of mishandling classified information, interestingly enough. And also under consideration is Stephen Hadley, who is a national security advisor in the second term of George W. Bush, the deputy national security advisor in the first. And he was the guy who made sure that the false intel about the uranium gathered from Niger made it into Bush's speech calling for a war in Iraq, a lie that he later owned up to. He also once advocated that the U.S. attack Syria with missiles without, of course, revealing that he owned large amounts of stock in Raytheon, one of the largest makers of missiles. Vice Admiral Robert Harward is also being considered for the position. Admiral Harward was the commander of JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, from 2006 to 2007, SEALs, Delta Force, all that stuff. This, of course, is very relevant because in a recent report by The Intercept about war crimes in SEAL Team 6, they noted that the process of canoeing became big in 2007. What is canoeing, you may ask? Well, it's the process of beating in the head of someone you killed until it looks like a canoe. So under Admiral Harward, SEAL Team 6 in particular, but JSOC overall, continued their generally lawless and always brutal style of war fighting. So while Flynn is gone, don't pop the champagne just yet, because there is a parade of hardcore militarists, some of whom don't mind war crimes, waiting in the wings to take his place. And finally here, just a quick note, now that Steve Mnuchin has been confirmed, he's looking to build out his team, and lots of the names are from, you guessed it, Wall Street. Goldman Sachs banker Jim Donovan and Justin Muzinich, formerly of Morgan Stanley, both looking to come in at high-level positions in the Treasury Department here in the next week or so. So just wanted to make sure our listeners had a quick update. The swamp is absolutely not being drained. It actually seems to be being filled even higher with more and more putrid water. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perger, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined to continue this conversation by Christian Parenti, who's an American investigative journalist, academic, and author. Christian, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me on.
No, of course, of course. And so I wanted to start with this news du jour, I guess it was, which is the Flynn situation. I mean, how are you parsing what's going on here? I mean, is the intelligence community sort of deliberately trying to sabotage Trump in the way that certainly they are alleging and others are alleging? Or is this just, you know, maybe just happenstance that one or two people in the messy transition are, you know, not who they said they were?
I definitely think that there is, you know, there's pushback. I mean, clearly it comes from the Democratic Party, right? The Democratic Party has been obsessed with this Russian theme, and that was part of Hillary's campaign, was essentially a promising ratcheting up of the new Cold War with Russia. And they did not let that go when they lost the election. And that appeals with, as you put in your monologue, you know, certain other elements in the national security establishment who are Republicans. And what we saw was that element breaking, the John McCain types. And they have a transcript of this call, and it sounds like they got Flynn on the Logan Act. I mean, as you also said, you know, you could probably find a lot of other people who are about to go into a new administration who are also technically in violation of the Logan Act and phone calls, but they're not supposed to conduct diplomacy, so they got him on this, is what it seems like. And, you know, he's reprehensible for all the reasons you laid out. And really, the one thing that I see in the Trump administration that is rational is this idea of de-escalating the relationship with Russia. That's the one thing that they have correct as far as I am concerned. And it is, as far as the insiders of the national security scene in D.C. are concerned, a cardinal sin, and it's something that they're going to pursue Trump on. And there may, in fact, be connections that compromise him. There have been articles about Russian loans to his company, about high quotes by one of his sons, about a large number of Russian investors in Trump properties. A lot of this luxury real estate that he develops is for flight capital anyway. I mean, I'm talking to you from New York City here, where there are entire neighborhoods that are at any one time up to 40% empty because the elites of the rest of the world use Manhattan real estate to launder and sort of park and secure money. Real estate transactions are subject to much less scrutiny than other kinds of financial transactions. So you can move millions of dollars into buying a property and then sell it and go undergo much less scrutiny than if you tried to do that by buying stocks and bonds. So the Trumps have a relationship with wealthy Russians who buy into their properties and keep the value of that stuff up. But I mean, who knows? Anyway, but there might be some connection. Nonetheless, at the same time, the fact that he's saying, I want to de-escalate the Cold War with Russia, to me makes a lot of sense. And it seemed like the opening in the armor because a couple of Republicans were ready to, that's a red line for them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, overall, the Trump administration is marked by total incompetence, right? I mean, they have both bad ideas, bad politics. It's the Coke agenda that Trump has put in place. He's handed over the creation of the cabinet more or less to the Cokes via Ryan Priebus and Vice President Pence. So these people like Betsy DeVos, right, they have terrible, far-right, fanatical free market politics. They're hell-bent on destroying the state. Bannon has said it himself. He said, I'm a Leninist, of the right. Apparently, he was in some class where they read on the state and revolution. He paid attention for that part where Bannon says you have to break up the old bureaucracies. But they're ideologically committed to trying to undo the state, which would be a disaster, not just for people, but actually for American capitalism. And American capitalism is much more dependent on public investment, public infrastructure, than anyone in the mainstream cares to let on. But they also, their sin is not just that they have bad ideas, it's that they're also totally incompetent, you know, and dangerous. And so I think that that's part of what's happened here is we've seen the fact that Flynn was sloppy caught up with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how do you evaluate the role of the media? I mean, sort of a lot of back and forth about what they're doing. I mean, obviously, you know, people are going to report what they get to some degree to try to get over on other people. But it just almost seems like, you know, the claims made by the intelligence community are never as bold as the ones that are made by the media. And they take those and then they add two or three random quotes. But without any sort of independent verification, I mean, it seems like to some degree, even though, you know, they may know more than their readers, it's a little bit irresponsible to either not release that information or put more qualifiers in a lot of these pieces so that if people are talking about it, debating it, trying to figure it out, there's not as much, you know, sort of gray area there and more sort of on the table about what we know and what we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that is a perennial critique of the media, right? They don't investigate very diligently. But, you know, the problem is actually not that the facts don't get out there. The problem is the punditry, right? The problem is that portion of the media, which is the spectacle and the spin, with the talking points and the countering of talking points on the talk shows. But most part of what's interesting throughout American history is how much of history is actually reported and then just buried and ignored. You know, it's reported once and there it is, and it's not discussed. So what you're talking about is, I think, at a certain level, not so much a technical failure of reporting, so much as it is the problem of an ideologically over-the-top chattering class that they, you know, by and large, are not going to talk about the real issues that Americans face, which are class issues, right? Which are issues of rising healthcare costs, an economy that is, despite its recovery, you know, profoundly stagnant and not providing enough jobs for people and not providing high-quality jobs, and rules of the game that have been rigged for 30 years in favor of big business, against labor, against workers. And people are suffering because of all this. And part of the reason people voted for Trump was because they were sick of this, the sort of what they saw as the sort of upper middle class managerial class of journalists, politicians, the head of the hospital or the insurance company that's screwing you over. Not so much the billionaires like Trump, not so much the actual owners, but the kind of like know-it-all managers who they see on television embodied in the in these talk shows. And yes, the media continues with a kind of out-of-touch discussion of the minutia of this or that take on, you know, Mar-a-Lago and the phone calls or this or that. But, you know, the deeper issues are what's going on with the American economy. What's up with American capitalism? And what's up with American capitalism is that 30 years of neoliberalism have really stripped away the economy's ability to grow. And what this economy needs in just a short-term sense is government policies that will basically put out of its misery the fossil fuel industry and point enormous amounts of money that are built up in the private sector. The private sector is sitting on more uninvested cash than at any time since these statistics have been kept in beginning in the late 50s. And businesses don't know what to invest in. So they sit on this stuff, then they bid up stocks, and that's how we get one bubble after another. And what has to be done is those vast pools of wealth need to be threatened with heavy-duty taxation and encouraged to invest in a clean energy revolution, right? And that's what will deliver another generation-long expansion and decent jobs, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't have anything like that conversation, either coming from, you know, the kind of mainstream liberals or the Breitbart-type free market fanatics or Trump. And what Trump did was he spoke to that pain and he played this ersatz populist. And there were a lot of people who went from Bernie to Trump. And one way that sounds kind of crazy, and it almost seems like one is impugning Bernie. But my wife is from Eastern Kentucky, and we went back there recently, and she was talking with a bunch of friends, and there were a lot of people who supported Bernie in the primary who ultimately voted for Trump because he was making these, you know, kind of more or less populist noises. I'm going to bring back the factories, you know, I'm going to slap on tariffs, et cetera, undo NAFTA. That's shorthand for like roll back deindustrialization. Of course, he has no intention of doing that, and it's partly because he doesn't really have much politics, and it's also partly because he is, by all accounts, highly incompetent, arrogant, ADD-suffering kind of a person. You know, he's not even really a property tycoon, right? He completely messed that up, and he became a branding organization after his casinos in the late 80s collapsed. And all the bankers that he borrowed from had a come to Jesus meeting with him, and they had to decide whether they were going to throw him and the whole Trump brand overboard and then be left holding all this worthless real estate, or whether they would basically use him as a paid front man to keep the value of this stuff up. And right. Since then, late 80s, early 90s, that is what the Trump Organization is. It is a publicity operation.
Indeed. We're going to have to take a break on that note, but we're going to come back here with more on By Any Means Necessary with Christian Parenti here from our studio in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing our conversation, talking a little bit about some of the current events you're talking about, the future of climate politics in America and how that relates to the economy. And we are very happy to continuing to be joined by Woo! All right. Tough day for me here on Valentine's Day. Christian Parenti, who's an American investigative journalist, academic, and author. And Christian, I wanted to pick back up on a point that you were making here towards the end that I think is quite relevant in terms of how we're viewing things in the country in terms of the relationship to climate change. And we talked a little bit about this the last time you were on the show, but I wanted to throw a little twist on the refugee issue, which obviously is a huge issue. And I was thinking about this morning with the cap of refugees being reduced from 100,000 to 50,000. And people are mainly talking about it in the context of wars, but also in the context of climate change, creating millions and millions of refugees, if to some degree, and that also fueling some wars, this issue could be sort of the defining issue of the next decade in a way when, I mean, now, you know, say 2 million people are trying to go to Europe or whatever, it seems huge. I mean, what happens when that's 15 million people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. Yeah, I mean, what we see at the push factors driving people out of their homes are wars. You know, primarily the key ingredient there is U.S. military intervention, right? Most of these people are coming from countries that have been or are being bombed by the U.S. But there is also this climate aspect. For example, you know, Syria going through one of the worst drought in really living memory. This causes this urbanization of Sunni farmers. They're in society dominated by Alawite Shia, more or less. You know, it's a breakoff of Shia Islam. So this class conflict and displacement becomes a protest slash political struggle along these sectional lines, these religious lines, and that breaks out into war. And, you know, there is a way that, and at the same time, Assad was implementing privatization, cutting social spending, et cetera, so as to get into the good graces of the West. So that made it even harder to absorb these farmers who had been pushed out of the land in large part by drought. So that, you know, that's part of what pushes people. And now what we see at the other end is that this has a very dangerous effect within Europe, right, where there's a hardening of European borders. Frontex has received a huge boost of technology and weaponry and money. And the domestic politics in a lot of these countries is moving in a hard right xenophobic direction. And that does not bode well for the next 10 years, absolutely. And of course, the weird political economic irony in all this is that Western Europe, at least, is turning into a geriatric ward. Mm. You know, there literally aren't going to be enough young people to change the bedpans of all the senior citizens. And really what Europe needs economically is all these people who are, you know, many cases, the best and the brightest of societies like Syria trying to come into Europe. But the xenophobia and racism is such that, even the center right is increasingly turning against these folks. And part of what the EU has done, in contradiction of all this stuff, is that, like, the way Europe has dealt with this demographic transition is by bringing in poor, or not necessarily poor at home, but, you know, bringing in Polish nurses and Polish bricklayers, et cetera, into Western Europe, particularly like England, instead of brown people. And what that leaves then in Eastern Europe is this bizarrely a kind of brain drain where there's actually a shortage in some cases of sort of like computer technicians and medical technicians at the same time that there it has been 20 years of deindustrialization. So you get these sort of aging populations with the professional prime working age, middle-aged folks moving west as much as they can for higher pay, and then sort of lumpenized working class youth stuck in these ghettos. And so then that becomes the context for the rise of a kind of paranoid politics of nostalgia that we see in the form of people like Viktor Orban and the other populist right parties in Eastern Europe who are the front lines of sort of, you know, the immigration crisis.
And as contradictions go in politics, one other interesting one here in the U.S. Has been the Justin Trudeau-Trump meeting. And a lot of people were sharing the photo of Trudeau looking like he didn't want to shake Trump's hand, although then he did do it. But I think a lot of people were sort of thinking, oh, well, Canada has this liberal prime minister and he's more progressive than Trump and he'll stand up. But it does seem like they have kind of a strange bedfellows relationship based on the politics of oil. I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be what is going on. Justin Trudeau backpedaled on oil a while ago, and that is a huge part of the Canadian economy. And I think he got the message that he was going to be opposed viciously and not get the money he needed for reelection unless he carried water for the oil industry. And that is what he has done domestically and what he's done here. And it is, you know, it's pathetic, it's cynical, it's short term. You can understand the kind of offer that can't be refused sort of situation in which Justin Trudeau convinces himself that now is the time and he has a responsibility to Canada to keep the Stephen Harper type conservatives at bay, and so he has to make his deal with the devil. But, you know, in reality, it's, I think, a disaster because we have to start dealing with this energy transition. And these politicians will be remembered as not doing that. And another interesting thing in all this, you know, is like China is now stepping up and increasingly taking a role of global leadership. Right. Xi Jinping went to Davos. and also China, also India to some extent, for local reasons of incredibly bad air pollution, they are making huge investments in renewable energy. Okay, it's starting from a very low base, but, you know, it's developing rather quickly. And it is, you know, it's not just some sort of greenwash talking point, but in fact, the truth that a lot of the world is going to be making the shift, is already making the shift to renewable energy. And the U.S. is deciding to not try and capture those markets and create technologies and sell technologies and employ people, et cetera, et cetera. And it's because of the special power of the fossil fuel industry. And particularly, I wouldn't want to reduce all of American politics to some sort of conspiratorial thing, but the Koch brothers are a very powerful set of political actors. And their father was a follower, not just of the John Birch Society, but of Hayek. Hayek, the Austrian economist who in the 1930s felt that his version of free market economics had been thoroughly defeated and wrote openly about how this was going to require a generation-long struggle in the realm of ideas to try and win back public opinion, and that what was needed was for rich people to invest in ideas. And out of that comes the modern think tank movement. And the Kochs were raised in that. Their father structured their inheritance so that they had to give away large amounts of money. Let it be noted, in lieu of paying taxes, federal taxes, because that's how these foundations work. So they were inculcated into this from a young age, that you are going to be giving away millions of dollars in the name of charity and avoiding taxes, and you need to have a sort of like political engagement doing that. And what they have done with the donors trust and the whole milieu of frequently highly wealthy, but ultimately like very kind of provincial and ignorant people like Betsy DeVos. You know, she inherits $1 billion. I think she's the Prince family, right? She's Eric Prince is her brother, and they come from an automobile family. They made the flip down visors. She then marries DeVos, who's one of the heirs to Amway. And I think he had something like $3 or $4 billion. So she's a billionaire who marries a billionaire, but she's from Western Michigan. She's an uptight, like in your business, ignorant provincial church lady who thinks she knows better, except that she has billions of dollars and has been investing in trying to destroy public education. So that whole movement of the rich is really significant. And they're not mistaken in, I'm not trying to say that, oh, this is an error and what they really mean to do is good. No, they know what they're doing. What they want to do is destroy the public sector. They want to destroy unions. They think that workers should have no rights, and they want everyone to work extremely hard for very little and obey their social betters. Yet at the same time, they are also these ignorant, frequently kind of incompetent, not very worldly idiots, as far as I'm concerned. And the worst thing that could happen to the American empire and American capitalism was before Betsy DeVos to have her way and to destroy public education. I mean, that is how you will get to a workforce that literally cannot find the hamburger button on the cash register. That will be a world in which people are joining the military and they're so ignorant that they can't even be trained how to run simple computer programs or fix a Jeep or whatever. So what we're in the grips of is capitalism eating away at its own social base, eating away at the real causes of economic growth, which are publicly encouraged public investment and then publicly channeled and ushered private investment. And also the social fabric, right? The human element of the society is being degraded through these education policies, through a disastrous healthcare system, through over-incarceration, right? The system is destroying its own base. And Trump is both a symptom of that. He's elected because people are responding to this kind of morbid phenomenon, sort of the sense that we're in a necrotic phase, low rates of growth, heavy-duty deindustrialization, massive addiction, right? And they want out. And so he's a symptom of that, but then he also is an agent. He's pursuing it even further. He can't pay attention to briefings. He can't be bothered to read anything. So he hands everything off to these maniacs with this Hayekian notions of total free market liquidation of the public sector, and to lunatics like Bannon. you know, who thinks he's got these ideas about the fourth turning, and he really thinks that we're at some point in American history where there's going to be a massive war and a kind of reconfiguration of American politics, and part and parcel of that is the destruction of existing institutions. And he has said that's what he wants to do, and that appears to be what he is trying to do.
Indeed. Indeed, it certainly does. Well, let me also ask your take on this, too, because I know you've done a lot of work on mass incarceration. I mean, what has been your take on sort of the first steps they've made here in terms of Sessions coming in, these executive orders, and those different pieces there?
It's terrible, right? I mean, the question to my mind is, what's going to be the reaction? Take the immigration roundups that seem to be happening, right? It's like, at first, we think, okay, this is, you know, Obama was the deporter-in-chief, and he had, last year around this time, there was you know, kind of roundup, and this could have just been that again, but it seems to be more intense. The question is, you know, what kind of pushback is there going to be? And I'm heartened by the fact that there seems to be a lot of pushback. A friend of mine who lives in Michigan, worked in a slaughterhouse, was a Marine in the first Gulf War, is married to an undocumented woman. His brother-in-law is due to be deported because on vacation he got within 100 miles of the U.S. border, where local law enforcement and immigration authorities do not need probable cause to stop people. And so a state trooper saw our Mexican family, Latino family, whatever, you know, so just stopped him with no probable cause, and found that he was undocumented. Anyway, but this guy is now part of a political guy, but, you know, he's part of a group of families in this school that include otherwise totally apolitical people who don't get involved in these kinds of things, who are outraged that the federal government is going to come and break up their community. They're threatening this bilingual school, which is good and people like, and there are interesting combinations of people, you know, other kind of seemingly very conservative veterans in this group, sort of, you know, some religious types, people who do not normally get involved in this stuff, talking about we got to have phone trees and networks to, like, protect ourselves. That's happening all over the country. So that, I think, is really interesting. Will this mass mobilization that we're seeing turn into new forms of organization? And I have faith that it will, because we have seen this kind of 2 decades now of an evolving protest movement. First, there was the protests in Seattle, then that kind of dissipated. Then there's the protest against George Bush's war in 2003. That's defeated in that it has no effect on the war. Then there's the mobilization around the Obama canvas in 2008, and everyone is disappointed. Then there's the Occupation Wall Street, and, you know, that kind of fizzles out. But at each stage, people become more sophisticated. The networks between them are deeper and richer. They have more skills, better ideas, a better analysis. And I think what is being built on are those previous waves of mobilization and organization, which, even though they dissipate, leave infrastructure. And I forgot the most crucial one. I think the Bernie Sanders campaign was very important in terms of providing a very sort of mainstream left analysis, right? Mainstreaming socialism by Bernie going around saying, I'm a democratic socialist. And again, a lot of those people were veterans of the Obama canvas and Occupy Wall Street. A lot of this is the same types of people, you know, going through these, at one view, very different movements. Well, Occupy Wall Street is a bunch of anarchists, and Bernie is, you know, Wang as a Democrat. But yeah, when you look at the ground troops, it's like a lot of the same people. And now they're mobilizing all over the country, places that you'd never think you'd see these protests. And the question is, what kind of organization will be developed out of that? And so far, signs are good. Also, I think it's very good that people, the tactic of going to the airports. I went to that protest here in New York. I was so glad that people went to the airports where people were being detained. People easily could have gone to some symbolic target. They could have said, let's go mobilize at the federal building or something. But instead, they hit the airport. They shut down terminals of airports. That raises the level of disruption. It raises the cost for the system to pursue these hard right policies. So we shall see where it all goes, but we're definitely in for 4 interesting years.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. We have about 2 minutes here until we close. I want to know really quickly, do these activists need to watch out for co-option by the Democratic Party, or is that not really a big issue?
Well, I mean, that is always a risk, but I think that what I've been saying is people need to swarm left, right? So the anarchists who want to, like, you know, get out in the street and oppose the alt-right, that's what they're going to do. They're not going to become, you know, Bernie, our revolution types, and nor the middle-aged Bernie, our revolution types going to become, you know, black bloc street fighters, right? People are going to do what they're going to do. There's certainly a risk of the Democratic Party trying to co-opt people, but there is also the fact that the Democratic Party is an important institution, even as it's problematic. If we are to oppose further redistricting by the Republicans in 2020, that's going to have to involve some reorganization and revitalization of the Democratic Party and some victories by Democrats. So I think that it is a danger, but it does not translate into one should never deal with Democratic Party. I think that would be silly. And I think there are good things happening. I mean, a lot of Bernie supporters essentially took over the Democratic Party of California. Democratic Party has been pushed to the left. Here in New York, we have Andrew Cuomo, not a particularly progressive guy, is now said he's going to move legislation, push legislation to make higher education in the CUNY schools and in the state schools free. I mean, this is a Bernie Sanders demand, and he made this announcement with Bernie next to him. So at one level, you say, okay, that's, you know, and then Chuck Schumer bringing Bernie into Senate leadership, you say, okay, that's co-optation. Yeah, I guess, but it's also a rational response by these mainstream Democrats to realize that we're going to die, wither on the vine, unless we harness some of this energy. And to do that, they have to make real compromises. I mean, if Andrew Cuomo, who obviously wants to run for president, can, in fact, deliver free tuition to public schools in New York for higher education, I mean, that will be very significant for people here in New York, and it will be a very potent symbol nationally. Say, no, it can be done. This is not pie in the sky. This is eminently reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to pause it there. That was Christian Parenti. Please check out all his work. We are going to take another break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about, well, some of the news that you are, I'm sure, all paying attention to and that we've been talking about throughout the show regarding militarism in this country and things happening inside of the military-industrial complex, and also some of the issues that labor is having intersecting with this and other race and issues and so on and so forth. So we are joined by Reese Chenault, the National Coordinator for U.S. Labor Against the War, for this conversation. Reese, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to just start here quickly with the news of the day. You know, a lot of people celebrating here that Mike Flynn has been, you know, removed from the National Security Advisor. I mean, certainly an odious individual in many different ways. But, you know, looking back looking forward to the people who may potentially be coming in behind him, all of them with deep resumes in the Iraq occupation, the Afghanistan war, and things like that. So, I mean, it seems like maybe a little premature to celebrate given how systemic this kind of militarism is inside of the government apparatus.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. For one thing, I mean, you know, pulling back a little bit, you got to assume that the bench that they've got to pull from is going to be fairly deep anyway, just because, yeah, I mean, there were other applicants for this job, so to speak, but Mike Flynn was really the person that they wanted, and now that he's no longer going to be an option for them, you know, it's only you don't have to do much imagining to really think about what horrible individuals they could have next up on the list. I'm actually really more concerned with, again, pulling back, the idea that that a lot of the problems with this particular situation are going to get laid at the feet of this person, when we know that the letter that he wrote, you know, basically took a lot of the blame away from characters that we know are responsible, you know, Trump and Pence being some key figures there. So I think when people are celebrating, you know, I gave myself a moment to be, you know, to kind of smirk about the situation, but, you know, there's more coming. And to be honest, this is just the tip of the iceberg, right? There's so many other deeply horrifying things about this administration that aren't going to end because Michael Flynn is leaving town.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think that's honestly, I think you're right. The bench is deep and whoever they bring next will probably have at least a similar skill set, as it were. I mean, one of the big things that was notable about Flynn in that regard was this overall issue of his views towards Muslims, which were, I mean, he called Islam a cancer. It was really sort of an unbelievable piece. And it seems like, you know, that sort of reality, that sort of hard edge. And now, of course, with everyone kind of in the government that he wanted to get in there, you obviously have, you know, Betsy DeVos, who's trying to get rid of public education. You have Jeff Sessions, who, you know, one time said something positive about the Klan. So Flynn is gone, but Steve Bannon is still there, you know, who ran Breitbart. So it seems like certainly at the very least, sort of the both militarized and I think feeling that this is going to be an administration that really it takes a more forceful attitude towards the issues of communities of color, but in a negative way, that's going to continue sort of no matter what, just looking at who's around there.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to go far in this administration to find someone who has something nasty to say about people of color. And you certainly don't have to work that hard to find someone who's got a crazy idea about national security. And judging by the fact that good old Donald is just signing whatever Steve Bannon puts across his desk, you can only imagine what kind of influence folks like him are going to have with I think he was in the Navy once or something.
Yes,
and that's what's
for like 47 years or something. Being,
yeah, great. Yeah, that's a lot of experience there. So
It's certainly an interesting piece. Allegedly, this guy, Stephen Miller, is chairing the National Security Council. But let me swing around to another relevant issue here, and one we've talked a little bit about before. And just speaking of militarized things, I actually saw a very interesting picture over the weekend of a bunch of militarized cops getting ready to raid a camp at Standing Rock. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting, and I think especially from the labor perspective where I know you're working, when I kind of sort of bring these things together, because the other issue that is also an issue for labor is sort of an intense patriotism in a lot of these similar unions like the building trades that are also, you know, very heavily supportive of the pipeline projects and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, it just sort of seems moving forward that labor has sort of some race issues, some blind patriotism issues that really aren't putting them in a position to really play a leadership role as it concerns, you know, the resistance we're seeing now.
I think it's telling that when I talk to folks in different parts of the country who are involved in, say, their Central Labor Council, and they found that they're having problems getting their folks who are in the trades to show up to the regular meetings of the Central Labor Council. And as a result, because of the sway that a lot of building trades have over Central Labor Councils, they're having difficulty getting a quorum together. So I think on that level, you know, in terms of the ability for like labor organizations that are, you know, depending on where they are, have some kind of history in the community and can really be a place to get things done for workers, the trades hold a special significance. You know, there's a lot of debate around, people are talking about the trades going to meet Trump and the building of the wall and the pipeline and how this is all kind of temporary jobs. And I mean, the reality is that for a lot of trades folks, most of their work is temporary work. And it's really just about their ability to maintain their benefit is dependent upon how much of that work that they take. So it's a really complicated situation internally, not justifying it, not saying it's right, just saying that's where they're coming from. And the issue then becomes, how do you have a conversation with folks who have decided that that is more important in the case of Standing Rock than your ability to maintain your heritage and, you know, sacred locations that have belonged to, you know, your blood for thousands of years. And how do you talk about that in a place that gives some kind of respect to a view, you know, as much as you can, while at the same time maintaining your own dignity? And for me, you know, I've had a lot of different bites of this apple, and what I've been able to come down on, ultimately for me, when I'm having these conversations with folks, is that the issue here isn't really just around these different issues that kind of nibble at the edges. let's just be clear about what this is. This is surface level solidarity, right? Like, the real meaning of solidarity isn't just like sticking with each other, with our brothers and sisters, all of our brothers and sisters, when times are good. It's about having tough conversations and being willing to listen to people, and also being willing to recognize that the structures that we've come to rely on as a labor movement have not, you know, and this is being really generous, but have not been fair to everybody. In fact, they've usually been for one or two groups of people. And it's only been recently that the doors have opened just a little bit to other folks, and in really selective ways, right? So we need to be thinking about that as a labor movement. Like, what do we really mean when we say solidarity? Is solidarity just with folks who have contracts? Well, in addition to being, you know, morally wrong, it's also strategically kind of, I'm not going to say dumb, I'm just going to say it's not possibly not the best move, since, you know, we're barely tipping over single digits into double digits in terms of density in the United States. So is that strategically a smart idea for us to just narrowly define solidarity as only the people who have contracts? Isn't solidarity with all kinds of working people? Isn't solidarity with folks who may have criminal records? Isn't solidarity with folks who may be struggling under the weight of trying to be documented, or struggling under the weight of trying to figure out what it means to, say, work in a rural area or work in an urban area? Like, real solidarity is tough. It's hard. It's hard to do, but it's worth it, right? It's worth it for us to have bigger and better movements. It's worth it for us to be stronger in that way. I feel like that's the conversation we should be having, and that is not the one we're having in the labor movement right now. It's really fractured. Everybody's picking at each other, and it's kind of a brother and sister kind of picking. Like, people know what the pressure points are with each other at this point. Like, these are not new issues for folks. And I think it's interesting that this is happening actually in a year where we're going to be entering a national conference for the AFL-CIO in the fall. And I'm interested to see how that's going to go, right? Because ultimately, the issues that we're grappling with in terms of labor right now are bigger issues than just folks who fall under that umbrella, right? So are we going to be open to the fact that we might have some situations in St. Louis this year where folks are showing up who aren't part of the traditional labor movement, but have participated with us, say, at a central labor council, and want in some form or fashion to be heard? You know, are we going to see building trades folks really putting it all on the line and saying, I don't think we can be together? Is that going to be a full coalition, right? I mean, people are always talking about the building trades. Well, that's actually not a really deep and tight group. Not everybody showed up to the White House. Not everybody showed up to that meeting with Trump. Lots of different unions didn't. So what does that mean?
Well, and I think that's a great point. And in some ways, I mean, it speaks to sort of why unions are maybe specially placed to even be having this conversation. I mean, you know, Minnesota, it's a state with a lot of unions. Minneapolis, you know, if you're like a Somali fast food worker at this stage in the game, you got to be worried about ICE. You got to be worried about your wages in the fight for 15. And you got to be worried about the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And it just sort of seems like right in that one sort of identity, and there's many people who are like that. I mean, labor is sitting sort of at the intersection of a lot of these conversations. And I think that's to some degree where we've been sort of had a disservice by this hard rigidity between identity and class, and not really understanding how they work together, and maybe even missing some layers of the conversation that we could be having. And certainly on immigration, at least, AFL-CIO very, you know, vocal. Obviously, the brother who's the vice president is Ethiopian background. But at the same time, then they're not touching terrorism. You know what I'm saying? So it's like they're almost kind of hinting at it without going full into it.
Right. But I also think that points to the idea that I think people internally know, obviously, that at this stage, not everybody has been welcome to the table. Even folks who, quite honestly, have earned their place there within the rules that have been set by this establishment. And so as a federation, particularly after this huge loss in the elections where they spent boatloads of money, now they're facing this idea that they're going to be attacked on all these different sides and that they're at kind of a weak point and they're running out of allies in terms of political strength because the DNC is really hurting right now. So I think a challenge moving forward is going to be, first of all, you know, can we be a trusted actor in these spaces, right? Because there's been some great moves. I mean, I think the current Civil and Human Rights Department and the AFL-CIO is amazing. And they've done some incredible work with a room full of people that have got to be really tough to talk to about this particular set of issues. And I think Tafari, the brother you mentioned, is also doing an amazing job too. But in the end, right, it can't just be Tafari. It can't just be that one department. You know, this has got to define the federation moving forward. And, you know, admittedly, U.S. Labor Against the War is an organization that isn't recognized by the AFL-CIO as a recognized affinity group. But in a way, because of the issues that we tackle and because of the memberships that we often end up working with, I'm actually really not that surprised most of the time because it takes a lot of political edge and it also takes a lot of conversation that just hasn't happened in order for people to really embrace the stuff that we regularly end up talking about.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And it certainly, it speaks to one of the other issues in the AFL-CIO that people have pointed out for years, which is the international department and the pieces they have brought together in terms of foreign policy, which haven't been that fantastic, as it were. But, the thing that it makes me think of, though, too, in terms of what USLAW is able to do and has been able to do is, I think, this ultimate issue of kind of a more sort of rank and file approach. I mean, you guys, work with locals and things like that, but it's sort of, you're not officially recognized, but you're working at that, let's say, grassroots level, not purely rank and file. But I mean, how important too on these issues is it to sort of incubate that kind of organization inside of labor to have these conversations? Because I think there are, as you said, even in some of the worst, I don't want to say the worst, but even in some of the unions that have taken some of the more, negative positions, I'm sure there are many people who still care about climate change or whatever it may be, Native rights, Movement for Black Lives, whatever it is, and creating spaces by which, locals and individuals and grassroots networks can actually make that start to be real seems like an important task to me.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've been thinking about is, a vehicle that often ends up showing up locals where we have a good base is a Peace and Justice Committee, which is a really interesting way to like you say, incubate, folks in terms of an organized group that wants to focus on some stuff that might be a little to the left of their union's normal set of politics. And I find it interesting that particularly in this time period, we've seen a real growth in interest in that kind of thing. Folks don't necessarily have an idea about how to make that happen, so we have to help them push that along. But in general, what we're seeing is that people have had these ideas for a while, but there's nothing like a good villain to really make you feel the necessity of it. And the Trump White House, filled to the brim with, the League of Supervillains that they've put together has really made that up front and center for folks. I'm also interested in the fact that a connection to immigrants and immigrant rights has really exploded in terms of interest, particularly around the so-called Muslim ban. A lot of folks are really, really worried, but haven't necessarily explored, besides the normal, who are the Muslims in my community? Where do they come from? How do I interact with them on a daily basis? How do I interject myself, if there's danger? But there's also a larger sense of like, how do I contribute to Islamophobia, which I think is an incredible thing that's kind of sprung out of this. And for us, what I think is also interesting is the fact that we're not, recognized by the AFL as like a quote unquote affinity group actually really works in our favor. Being an outsider, being an insurgency, in this climate proves to be really useful. People feel like they want to be on the outside of institutions, you know, and there's good and bad to that. So, it's an interesting time to try and do this work. And we're trying to explore the best way to be helpful to people. Because at this point, it's kind of like trying to drink from a fire hose. Like, it's a lot of interest. It's a lot of energy and power. So you want to be careful about how you interact, right? Like, you don't want to suppress that kind of energy. You want to encourage it.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point, and I appreciate all of that, and I hope everyone can go check out U.S. Labor Against the War. If you are listening and you are a trade unionist, get involved with them. That was Reese Chenault, who is their national coordinator. That is going to do it for us on today's show here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.